So there's a pasuk in Navi, Dover Beito Mato. It's good to talk about things when they are relevant. Nobody likes to talk about things that are no longer relevant. So I was thinking, it's not often that there's a simcha in Kalispil. And I know the last couple of days we've been talking about different things about framing our experience of being here. But when we are in Kalispil and there happens to be a simcha that's going on tonight, maybe it's just something to focus on, something to think about. So Rabbi Wolf, who was with us the other day, he's going to be with us for Shabbos as well, is the shliach here in Montana, in Kalispil. He made an upsharon this evening, which is a major milestone in his family.
It's a big deal.
I don't know. I tried to feel him out whether or not we should all come, whether we should crash, but I don't know. I'm not sure. So we chose not to, but I thought it was just an opportunity to think a little bit. Obviously, none of us are making an upsharon, but it's an opportunity to think a little bit about the message of what that's all about and how it's applicable to all of us who are here, who may be just a little bit beyond the age of 3. So first of all, there are different minhagim, different customs. Some communities have this interesting custom of waiting 3 years to cut a child's hair, and some people do it right away. They don't wait around. It so happens my family custom is not at all to wait around. But where does this come from? So some suggest that the source of all of it is because we're told that when one plants a tree, the Torah says, "Va'araltem arloso espirio." You have to wait 3 years before being able to reap the benefits of that tree. You have to wait around for the first 3 years, leave everything aside. It should be almost as if it's off limits. It's in the property of the Ribono Shel Olam, it's in God's property, and we are not allowed to have any benefit, any use of it. And to make the same kind of comparison to a child, so how do you end off that sentence? I've always had a hard time ending off. So, the first 3 years of the child's life are? Years of growth that we are not allowed to have benefit from?
Unlike right? The hair, right?
Right, so it's not, doesn't exactly follow through. So it's a little hard to...
There's no net to Revi also.
What?
There's no net to Revi.
There's no net to Revi, correct. Exactly. So it's a little hard. So they say... Some say, yeah... So it's a little hard to say. So the truth is, you do find the Shari Tshuva. Now, make no mistake, there are two extremely significant Shari Tshuvas. One Shari Tshuva is written by Rabbeinu Yonah, who was one of the greatest of the Rishonim. That is a Sefer of Musar that Rabbeinu Yonah wrote, which is a very, very fundamental Musar Sefer. Aside from that, one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch is called the Shari Tshuva. On every page in Shulchan Aruch HaRachayim, you have the Shari Tshuva, and it's a very, very significant and important milestone. It's a trademark of what the Shulchan Aruch is, but basically the Shari Tshuva writes in Hilchos Chol HaMoed that although the halacha is that we're not allowed to have a haircut on Chol HaMoed, he says, if somebody wants to observe the minhag of having an upsharon on the third birthday, one would be allowed to do that even on Chol HaMoed. So you see that this is something, it's not just a made-up minhag, it's not something that has no roots, it's not something that has no source. It is something to the fact that we would even go so far as to say that one would be able to potentially do so on Chol HaMoed, which is something that we try usually not to do. So what's it all about? I think the celebration of an upsharon is really about celebrating the fact that this child's beginning of his life has been something that has been started on the right foot. That the chinuch is about to begin, but it's something that really we celebrate this milestone in a child's life, that he has the opportunity to start it off on the right foot. There's a pasuk in Sefer Koheles. Tov acharis davar mereishiso. So Rashi there explains. What does it mean, tov acharis davar? So Rashi says, I'm going to tell you the words. At the beginning of an endeavor, we don't know what it's going to be like. So everybody signed up to be on this program. You don't know exactly how you're going to be treated. You don't know what the cabin's going to look like. You don't know if the food is going to be good. You don't know anything. Then you get here, you start to see. It's much more satisfying at the end when you know that we've just successfully gotten through a period in our lives, and we see what the product is, and we're happy with it, and we're excited about it, and without all the anxieties. Sometimes in the beginning, we have anxieties about things because we don't know where it's going to go. We don't know where it's going to lead us. So, tov achris davar merishiso. Sometimes the end product is far more exciting than the beginning. That's what Rashi explains. However, aside from that Rashi, the Imre Emes has a very famous comment where he suggests, no, tov achris davar, why is it that sometimes we have such great success at the end result of what it is that we are trying to get to? Meirei Shiso is because at the beginning, at the foundational moments of when you started on that journey, when you started on that endeavor, It was something that was done properly. And when you have the right foundations and you have the right roots and you begin things properly, then you know that all that comes later on is going to be successful as well. It's interesting that in Parshas Bahaloscha, the Torah says, Bahaloscha es haneros. Aaron HaKohen is given an instruction that he should light the candles. So much so that Rashi on Chumash says that Aaron was complaining that he wasn't able to be a part of the whole experience in putting together the Beis HaMikdash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, don't worry. Shalcha godol mishalahem. You have nothing to worry about. I'm going to give you an opportunity to light the menorah. And that's going to be your contribution. So, sounds very nice, sounds very beautiful. However, when you look in the Gemara Maseches Yuma talks at great length about what exactly are the details of what's necessary to light a menorah. The Gemara clearly states that hadlaka ksheira bizar, that you're allowed to have a non-kohen be designated to light the menorah. Now, you have a technical issue. How is a non-kohen going to get inside of the Beis HaMikdash where he's not supposed to go? Okay, you figure it out. But technically, we would assume that a non-kohen is allowed to light the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash as well. Well, if that's the case, why does the Torah explicitly say B'haloscha es haneros? This is not my question. This is the question of the Rishonim in the beginning of Maseches Yuma. So the Meshech Chachma on Chumash answers in Parshas B'haloscha. He says, you're right. Whereas on a normal day, anyone has the right, anyone has the ability to light the menorah. But the very first time, when you're trying to lay the foundations of a Beis HaMikdash, when they were just consecrating the Mishkan and starting it all off, that had to be done in the most pristine fashion. That had to be done by the greatest person who was, Aaron HaKohen. Later on in history, it could be done by anyone. But the first time has to be done with very strong roots, very strong foundations. And that's what he suggests is the reason why Aaron HaKohen is the one who was told to do it. Which is similar to a question that is asked by the Pnei Yehoshua. So we're familiar with the whole story of Hanukkah, and there's a big discussion about exactly how the miracle transpired, how it unfolded, exactly what happened. But there's a very fundamental question that sometimes we may not think about. The Pnei Yehoshua is one of the foremost commentaries on Shas, writes, he really doesn't understand what the whole to-do is about the story of Hanukkah. After all, we celebrate the fact that they looked around and they couldn't find anything pure, and they finally found some little jug that had the stamp on it, and they knew it was okay, and then they went ahead and did what they had to do. Why do you need that? Ask the Pnei Yehoshua. We have a halacha, we have a rule, Tuma Hutra Betzibur, which means if the entire Jewish community, or if most of the Jewish population at the time is in a state of impurity, is Tameh, so we know that you're allowed to bypass this general requirement of Tahara, of purity, and you go ahead and you do the Avodah, you do the service in the Beis HaMikdash. Well, if that's the case, ask the Pnei Yehoshua, at this time, there was nothing pure that was available, so couldn't they use anything? So what was the reason for the whole miracle? Why did God do this? So the answer that is given, many, many different answers are given, very important question, but Rabbi Yosef Engel, one of the very interesting, fascinating personalities, pre-war Europe, suggests in his Sefer Gulyone HaShas that perhaps the reason why is because, no, here they were being mechanech the Beis HaMikdash. Here they were coming for the very first time after watching and experiencing a defiled edifice. Now they had to reconsecrate it. In order to reconsecrate it, you're not going to rely on a bidyevet situation. When you're laying a foundation for something, it has to be perfect. It has to be up to standard. It has to be exactly the way it's supposed to be. In Parshas Pekudei, the Torah actually writes, Eile Pekudei HaMishkan, Mishkan HaEdus. When it refers to the Mishkan that they built in the Midbar, in the desert, so it's referred to as Mishkan HaEdus. What does that mean, Edus? Edus means, what?
Testimony.
So what does that mean? This is the covenant of testimony? How do you explain that? What's the testimony? So Rashi says, no. Testimony means this is a Mishkan, and it's beautiful, and it's built in a very specific way with all the parameters that were laid out in Chumash itself. Eidos means this is the testimony to the Jewish people that God had forgiven them for the terrible, terrible mistake that they made when they served the Egel Azov. Now, how is this a testimony? Because Rashi says, if God would not have forgiven them, He never would have come to reside His presence in anything that they had built. He would still be angry at them. And from the fact that He decided to come and reside His Shechina in the Mishkan, it obviously meant this was an Eidos. This was the way for all of us to realize that we were forgiven for this terrible mistake. Obvious question. What's the obvious question? What's the obvious question? There is a pasuk in Chumash where we're told that HaKadosh Baruch Hu prides himself in the fact that he is shochein itam b'soch tumasam. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu is proud of the fact that even when the Jewish people anger him, and even when they let him down, and even when they do everything wrong, and even when they are in a state of total defilement, still, HaKadosh Baruch Hu prides himself over the fact HaShochein itam b'soch tumasam, that he still resides with all of us. His presence is still felt, even in that state. Well, if that's the case, what is the proof? Mishkan Ha'edus. How is that an Edus? How is that a testimony? Even if we were not forgiven, God would have resided in Shechina together with all of us. And the answer is no. That's true in a normal circumstance. But not when you are going to resurrect from new. To start a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam by building a Mishkan is only possible if you get everything else out of the way. Those foundations need to be strong. And that is something that the Torah points out to us. The Sefer Shem Yishmuel, I quoted him the other night, writes that this is the reason why the Gemara says a fascinating story about a Ben Sora Amoru. So the Torah tells us in the beginning of Parshas Kisetze, we're going to read in a few weeks, about this unusual circumstance of Ben Sora Amoru is not listening to his parents, and he has to be brought to the Beis Din, and they punish him, the whole thing. Now the Gemara then goes into the details of the qualifications of exactly how the story is able to unfold. And it's almost an impossibility to the fact that the Gemara says there are some opinions that say that this is something that actually never happened, because it's so unlikely that any of these, that all of these qualifications, all these factors will actually come to play. Now, one of them that the Gemara says is, it's only in the first 3 months after the child becomes a bar mitzvah. So you have to have a child whose mother and father look the same, who a whole bunch of qualifications, the Gemara says, and he does all of this only within the first 3 months after his bar mitzvah. So many mefarshim ask, why? What's the insistence first 3 months? If you have somebody who's rotten, somebody who's a menace to society, somebody you're going to be concerned about in the future, he's going to do terrible things. So, even if he's 25 years old, we should get rid of him. Why is it only if he's 13? The answer is, no. Plenty of people do things wrong in their lives, and there's ways to get around it, and they mature. When a child is 13 years old and just starting out his adult life, if he doesn't get that perfectly, right? If he doesn't get that perfectly, what's going to be with his future? Because so much of our success is Tov Achris Davar Merishiso. So much of that success comes from the beginning. So there's a fascinating story. Anybody here heard of Reb Simcha HaKohen Kuk? He actually passed away this year. He was a phenomenal Talmud Chacham, an extremely charismatic personality. He was pretty close with my father. He was the chief rabbi of Rehovot. So we had met him on many occasions when he came to see my father, or we went to Eretz Yisrael, we saw him. So he once told me an amazing story. And it's a story that's actually written without all the details. Of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a tshuva where he writes the basic story. And Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank also has a tshuva where he writes a different variation of the story, but it's all basically the same story. Rav Kook filled in all the details and he told us what happened. One of the great tzaddikim of the last generation was a personality by the name of the Aderes. The Aderes, by his bris, they did not give him the name Aderes. His name was Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Tumim. Now that's a mouthful to say that. Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Tumim, he was a twin. So Tumim is twins. So they referred to him as the Aderes. That was the way to shorten his name. The Aderes was known as a phenomenal Talmud Chacham. And he was the Av Beis Din in Panevish for 19 years. Panevish in Europe was an extremely prominent city. And he held this position for 19 years. He was mistreated the entire time that he was there. He had 12 children. 9 out of the 12 died from malnutrition and simply from illnesses that were rampant around the town. He had many, many great hardships in his life. Among them was the hardship that his community really underpaid him, and they weren't able to take care of him at all. So even though he had this position of prominence, and he was the Av Beis Din of this very important city, he really was not being taken care of by the inhabitants of the city at all. To the point that along came a delegation from a much smaller, insignificant town called Mir. So now the Mir Yeshiva is very well known, and Panevish is very well known. But at the time, they were two little cities. Panevish was very prominent, Mir was very small. And the Mir town realized that they have this rabbi who's very, very special, but he's being mistreated. Why don't we offer him a better deal that he should come and move to our community? So they poached him. And they came to discuss the opportunity of him considering moving to the other community. After a whole discussion with them, he realized maybe this is going to be better for the remainder of his family that was still alive. And he agreed that he was going to leave Panevish and he was going to go to the city of Mir. Later on, his community found out that he had just had this negotiation without them knowing anything about it. They felt so bad. And finally, they came to an understanding that they were going to take care of his salary. They were not going to take advantage of him anymore. And they made him a counteroffer to stay. So, in the end, he really was faced with a major dilemma. On the one hand, he has this very prominent position. Now, I don't think he cared so much about the prominence, but he had the opportunity to make such a tremendous impact on a major Jewish community. Or he can move to another community and have a much smaller impact. The problem was he already gave them his word that he was going to move. But now his beloved community in Panevish felt, you know, why didn't you give us a chance to negotiate? So he didn't know what to do. He sent the Shiloh to the Snechemet. Snechemet was a major genius. If you've never seen, he has an encyclopedic work. It's 10 volumes where he goes through everything, literally everything under the sun, tiny Rashi print, every single topic you can ever think of. So the Snechemet was presented with the Shiloh by the Aderim. They were very close friends, and they have a lot of chilufei mechtavim. If you look at the Snechemet, you'll find there are a lot of letters back and forth between the two of them.
That's unusual. Snechemet was Sfardi.
Yeah, the Snechemet. The Snechemet was a Sfardi, but he has actually a lot of chilufei mechtavim with the Aderim in the Snechemet itself. You'll find he quotes him a lot. So here, he sent the Shiloh to the Snechemet, and he asked him, as somebody who I respect very much, what should I do? On the one hand, I'd like to stay here in Panevish because my opportunities are much greater. On the other hand, I already gave my word to the community in Mir, so I'm not sure what to do. The Snechemet goes through a lengthy discussion to explain why he feels that he's allowed to be backtrack on his word, and he's allowed to go back to the old community of Panevish, and he does not have to go ahead with his commitment to Mir. In the end, the Aderis said he feels so uncomfortable being a person who's not going to be a man of his word. He said, my whole life I've been careful to be a man of my word. Now I'm going to break it. If I gave them my word, I'm leaving. That's what he did. Anyway, that's all the background to the story of the Aderis. He comes to Mir. His aspiration in life, his dream in life was that at some point he was going to be able to move to Yerushalayim and somehow figure out how to support his family there. But that was almost an impossibility at the end of the 1800s. This was something that was unfathomable, something nobody was even going to consider. So there were very small communities of Jews who were there in Yerushalayim at the time. But he very much wanted to go, and he said, if I get an opportunity to somehow make it work, so I'm going to do it. One fine day, 1905, he gets a letter from Rabbi Shmuel Salant. Who was Rabbi Shmuel Salant? He was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. Rabbi Shmuel Salant sends him a letter that he's very, very old. He's almost 90 years old. And he realizes he's not going to live forever, so it would be a good idea for him to hire an assistant rabbi. And the understanding was that you should move to Yerushalayim. You'll be the assistant rabbi. At some point when Rabbi Shmuel Salant is unable to fulfill his commitment to the community as being the chief rabbi, then you'll take over. You will be the chief rabbi. So that was a very exciting prospect for him. In 1905, he moves to Yerushalayim. A very tragic end to the story was he came to Yerushalayim and he actually passed away 1 year later at the age of 60 or 61 years old. And Rabbi Shmuel Salant lived till like 95. So Rabbi Shmuel Salant outlived his young assistant rabbi, who the whole plan was that he was going to outlive him. Anyway, didn't work out that way, but he had the opportunity to be in Yerushalayim. Okay, so far we didn't start the story. So what's the story? Story is as follows. Rav Kook said the story is that later on in history, the Aderis had a daughter who married Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, Rav Kook. So they became very close, as that was his son-in-law, that was his father-in-law. But he was very well known before Rav Kook came into the story. He was a great personality on his own. Anyway, so be it as it may, he comes to Yerushalayim that night. Rav Shmuel Salant wants to show all the leaders of the Jewish community in Yerushalayim how much he respects this younger Talmud Chacham who had come and move in to be the assistant rabbi. So how's he going to do that? How's he going to prove it to everybody? He goes that afternoon, right after the Aderis landed, right after he got there. So he goes and he tells him, I'd like you to know this evening, there's a very prominent family who's making a wedding in Yerushalayim. All the Gedolim of Yerushalayim are going to be there. All the great leaders are going to be there at the wedding. And I'm supposed to be the Masada Kedushin. And they all know it. Tonight, what I'm going to do is, I'm going to call you up to be the Masada Kedushin. And everybody's going to wonder, who is this? And then they'll all understand that if Reb Shmuel Salant gives so much respect to you, it means they should all respect you as well. Okay, very beautiful idea. That was the plan. So they come to the wedding. Everybody's there. All the guests are assembled. All the rabbis are there. And he calls them up and he says, the new assistant chief rabbi of Yerushalayim is going to be the Masada Kedusha. The Aderis walks up. He's about to start officiating the ceremony. Takes a cup of wine, about to make a Baruch Pi'ar Gafen. And by mistake, he makes a Shahakol Nia B'dvar. First night on the job. Anybody here ever heard this story? No? It's an amazing story. Makes a Shahakol. All the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim are there. They're all screaming and yelling, Shahakol, what do you mean? You have to make a Baruch Pi'ar Gafen. You're holding a cup of wine. He says, okay. Stops for a minute. Thinks. Takes the cup of wine again. Says, okay. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam. Baruch Pi'ar Gafen. Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank writes, all the Rabbanim jumped up again and they said, what are you doing? You never knew that in Shulchan Aruch it says, Simen Reish Vav in Aruch Chaim. The Shulchan Aruch tells us that if you have a situation where somebody mistakenly makes a Shahakol instead of making the appropriate bracha like Baruch Pi'ar Gafen, as long as you made a Shahakol, that's a catch-all bracha. So b'diavad, it's okay. So what are you correcting yourself? You made a mistake, which was terrible. Now you made another mistake. You made your bracha levatala. You made a new shahakol, which you didn't have to make. You made a new hagafen, which you didn't have to make.
Something like a good person.
What?
That's a bracha sanani.
Not
a bracha mitzvah.
Oh, so now we're getting fancy, right? So now we're getting fancy. So, under the chuppah, the whole fight breaks out. So Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank writes, some people said, oh, it's a bracha sanani, a bracha mitzvah. Is it really a bracha sanani? Not so clear. Anyway, a big fight all about the details of all this. Can you imagine such a chuppah? This is the Aderis' first night on the job. Can you imagine that? So, the Aderis defends himself. And he stands up to all the Rabbanim and he says, you're right. The Shulchan Aruch says that if a person makes a mistake and he says a Shahakol instead of a Baruch Pi'ar Gafen, b'dievet, it's okay, like you mentioned. It's fine. He doesn't have to make a new bracha. Why did I make a new bracha? He says, because there's a different rule. The Gemara says in Maseches Kiddushin, the Gemara gives an example. I think it's in Kiddushin or Bava Metzia, maybe both. So the Gemara says that if you have a situation where somebody makes a shaliach, somebody sets aside a proxy, and they say to this person, I want you to sell this piece of property. So we have some chevra here who are in real estate, right? So you send somebody to sell a piece of property, and he has no understanding of how valuable the property actually is. So instead of selling it for $1 million, he sells it to a buyer for $200,000. So he comes back, he says, oh, I found a buyer. Well, how much did you make on it? $200,000. $200,000? That was $1 million property. How do you sell it for $200,000? The Gemara says the Mechira is batel. You can undo this sale, and all the terms of the deal are off. How could that be? Ask the Gemara. A detailed discussion, Ein Anan LaKarko, is not really relevant for now. The Gemara says, why would the plan be off? So the Gemara answers, because when I send a shliach to do something on my behalf, my point in sending him was that he should do something positive for me. Not he should make me lose. The lashon of the Gemara is l'skune shadrisich v'lo la'avusi. I don't want him to ruin my life. I don't want him to do something negative for me. Look what you just did. You destroyed it. And therefore, your shlichus is batel. Your whole representation of me is off. And you had no right to sell my property unless you had my permission. So now it's as if you never had my permission. That's what the Gemara says. So the Aderis said, when we come under a chuppah and we make the bracha, who's making the bracha? The Masada Kedushin makes the bracha. Why is he making a bracha? He's not getting married. I always say when I'm Masada Kedushin at weddings in my neighborhood, so the chassan always looks at me and he says, Harei Amikudesh. I'm like, no, you're not marrying me. You should look at the kala and say, Harei Amikudeshly, right? So the Adera says, who is the one who's supposed to be saying the bracha under the chuppah? Really, who should it be? The chassan. He's supposed to make the bracha. The rabbi is really doing it on his behalf. Why do we do that? Because we don't want to embarrass someone. Maybe there are people who are illiterate. Maybe there are people who don't know how to read properly. They're not going to say the words carefully enough. So we don't want to embarrass anyone. So we made a system where the designated Masada Kedushin is always going to be the one to make the bracha on behalf of the chassan and kala. So he said, if I'm serving as a shliach to the chassan and kala, they only made me their shliach, they only made me their proxy to do something good for them. They don't want me to do a bracha b'dievet for them. And therefore he said, that's why I had to make the bracha again. It's a big chiddush. That's what the Aderis came up with under the chuppah. So the rabbis pounced on him again. They said, it sounds very nice, but if you look in Shulchan Aruch, you don't find this halacha by Kiddush Friday night or Havdalah Matzah Shabbos. Kiddush Friday night, usually one person makes Kiddush, and everybody's yotzi along. Havdalah matzah Shabbos, one person makes havdalah, everybody's yotzi along. Why doesn't the Shulchan Aruch say that
he's
if
not
a,
only
shlech, what?
He's also shlech.
Yeah, so maybe it's different.
He's doing it for himself.
He's doing it for himself also, right? So some say maybe that should be a difference. That's a big discussion. But here they said, shouldn't the Shulchan Aruch have thought of this case? Shouldn't the Shulchan Aruch have said, if a person is making Kiddush for a bunch of other people, making Abdallah for a bunch of other people, and he mistakenly says Baruch Pri HaGafen instead of saying, I'm sorry, he says Shahakal instead of Baruch Pri HaGafen, he should have to redo it. Why? Because a Shlichos is not able to do a B'diyeved when he's being sent on behalf of others. So the answer that was given to that is, no, no, no. All of that is true. But by a wedding, when you're setting up the foundations of a marriage, the foundations of a life, you're going to start off on a B'diyeved like that? How can this be? How can you start off like that? So the Achronim say that when we come to the beginning of the year, this is something we need to think about as well. We're, it's hard to think when we're here in Montana, but Lamaisa, Chodesh Elul is this Shabbos already, and we're blessed and we're privileged to have Reb Baruch with us, who's going to make it a very Heiligah Shabbos to make us feel the way we're supposed to feel during Chodesh Elul. And it's an opportunity for us to think about what the beginning of the year is going to look like. Tov Achris Davar Merishiso. Are we going to have a good end by making sure that we have very strong foundations? Are we making sure that in the beginning of the year, we're going to have an opportunity to make sure that everything is done properly and in the best of ways to make sure that the end result of what this year is going to be very special? We have time for one story. Shall I tell you an interesting story? Why not?
Sure.
Everyone can stay awake for another story. I actually read this story last year. Somebody sent me a clip from an Israeli newspaper. Such an amazing story. It's about Rav Yisrael Meir Lau. Anybody heard the story that he told last year about what happened at his bar mitzvah? Anybody here heard the story? Absolutely phenomenal story. So Rav Yisrael Meir Lau was asked to run a Zoom program for a number of bar mitzvah boys in Eretz Yisrael who had missed the opportunity to celebrate their bar mitzvahs during COVID. And the boys were feeling very bad. They all had dreamt of what they were going to have, what kind of celebration was going to be put together for them, and then COVID came and they weren't able to have anything. So they put together something on Zoom and they asked Rabbi Lau to be the main speaker for all these boys and give them chizuk. So he gets on this call with them and he says, let me tell you the story about my bar mitzvah. If you've never read Rabbi Lau's biography, it's phenomenal. It's amazing. Hebrew is even better than the English, but it's an amazing biography, amazing autobiography. So Rabbi Lau does not have the story in there. And he said, I'm going to tell you a story that I've never shared, but I think it's important to share with you. So he tells them that he obviously was raised as a Yasom. He was an orphan. He survived the Holocaust. And after the war, he was brought in by, I believe, his uncle, who lived in a certain yeshuv. I forgot what it was called. Anybody remember?
Haifa.
There was a specific name for it. I forgot what the place was called. A very small... I forgot. It was a very small community. And he said everybody in town was excited that, you know, this Yasum came to town, and they all felt like they had a responsibility to try to help him grow and develop. He didn't have parents, he didn't have family, and everybody was chipping in, everybody was helping him out. A couple of months before his bar mitzvah, an elderly gentleman in shul comes over to him, and he says, you know, it's almost your bar mitzvah, and some of the bar mitzvah boys in our community have the custom, have the practice that they lay in the bar mitzvah parsha. So do you have any interest in doing that? He says, of course I would like to, but who's going to teach me the parasha? I don't have a father. The old man says, don't worry. You stay every night after Mara for 20, 30 minutes over the next couple of weeks. I'll teach you. I'll stay here with you. We'll make sure you're all set for your bar mitzvah. Okay? So that's what he did. It was actually Parsha Shlach was supposed to be the bar mitzvah parasha. And he's preparing for this, and he's all ready, and he's so excited. And they hung up signs all over the community that everybody should come. This Shabbos, we're only going to have one minyan, Shabbos morning. That everybody's invited to celebrate the bar mitzvah of Yisrael Meir Lau, and he's going to lane from the Sefer Torah. It's going to be a big deal. They want him to be mechazik him. They want him to make him feel good. Okay, come Shabbos morning. Somebody in shul walks over to him and says, I want you to know I bought you a bar mitzvah present. I brought you your own talis. Most of the time, a young child borrows his father's talis when he lanes. This man understood that he doesn't have anyone to give him. So he said, I bought you your own talis. You should feel like a mensch. You have your own talis. He was so excited, he puts it on in the middle of Chazaras HaShatz. He's getting all ready. And he says, it comes time for Kriyas HaTorah. They're taking out the Sefer Torah. And he notices, out of the corner of his eye, that from the other side of the shul, Rab Mendel, who is the regular Balkori every week, is walking up to the Bima, getting ready to lane. So Rabbi Lau notices this, and he sees that the Gabbai is already standing up by the bima. The Gabbai calls out, and he says, Rav Mendele, you know, there's a bar mitzvah this Shabbos, you're not late. So this Alter Yid screams back at him, and he says, why didn't anybody tell me? He says, okay, you made a mistake. Maybe nobody told you, but now we're telling you. There's a bar mitzvah, you're not late this Shabbos. And he starts screaming and shouting at the Gabbai, I prepared, and I'm ready to lane, and you're going to tell me that I'm not lading? And especially this week, this is the most crowded the shul has ever been. You're going to take it away from me to show everybody what a proficient Baal Korei I am? Rabbi Lau described how all the windows of the shul had to be open because there was no room inside for everyone to stand. They had to stand around the perimeter of the shul to listen in from outside. So the Baal Korei gets so angry. Gabbai says, listen to me. I love you dearly, and I appreciate that you lane for us every week, but let me tell you, the reason they're all here is not because of you. They're all here because of the bar mitzvah boy, and they all want to hear him. Anyway, he was so angry. Rabbi Lau said he's watching all of this. 13 years old. He walks up to this elderly gentleman, and he says, listen, let me tell you the way I see it. Puts his arm around his shoulder, and he says, you're an elderly man. I don't know how many years you're going to have the opportunity to lane Parsha Shlach. I'm sure I'm going to have the opportunity to do this many times in the future. Let's make a deal. You do it this week, I'll do it next year, Parsha Shlach. And he walked off the bima. And he said that he felt that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw that the first mitzvah he did as an adult was he knew how to keep his mouth shut and he knew how to give respect to somebody else who clearly needed it. And he said, as a result of what he did, he feels HaKadosh Baruch Hu paid him back, and his voice has not stopped being heard for the last 80 years since. Such an amazing story. And he shared this for the first time with these bar mitzvah boys. And he said that you see what foundations can do to a person. You see how strong beginnings, if a person really understands doing something special at the beginning of their adulthood, at the beginning of any venture that they endeavor to begin, anything that they start can bring you to such great places. Now, obviously, he worked throughout his life to become the person who he has become. But he attributed so much of that to this incredible story that I think is a tribute to him, to nobody else but to him, a self-made man who had such tremendous sensitivity even at such a young age. Anyway, thought this was something to consider, something to think about. Mirz Hashem will have many opportunities before we go home, many opportunities to talk and learning, to learn together, to uplift each other, to inspire each other. But for now, I wish everyone a wonderful night of sleep.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.